ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nick Tiller has an academic foundation in kinesiology. That's the study of human movement and how it affects health. And he's worked alongside elite athletes and coaches as a performance physiologist at the UK's Olympic Training Centre. Before earning his PhD in applied physiology, he's held academic positions in England before moving to Los Angeles in 2019 to further his research at the prestigious Lundqvist Institute. Now, his research centres on exercise physiology and respiratory medicine, and also he's a specialist in the science of extreme exercise, a topic of personal interest, as Nick is himself an accomplished ultramarathon runner. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Skeptic's Guide to Sports Science, and he's done some work on all sorts of things which we believe in, do we or not? Fish oil cupping, saunas, stretching, all of that stuff. We'll discuss all of that in our first hour. You might have some questions for him too. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Nick, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Hi, Phil. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
No, it's terrific to have you back too. You wrote a great piece early this year about the three wellness mindsets. Well, we could all even talk about where this word wellness came from. As I say, once upon a time, I'm sure it was the health section. It's now the wellness section. But you say there are three main wellness mindsets we should be aware of. There are believers, there are bullshit artists, and there are liars. Tell me about them. Take me through them.
Yeah, well, I think when navigating this, the wild west of wellness, as I like to call it, I think it can be useful to split the kind of people that you're going to be dealing with on a day-to-day basis into roughly three categories. As you said, the believers, liars, and bullshitters, because each different group has their own motivations and beliefs, and learning to distinguish among them can really help you to make informed decisions. So a lot of people in wellness are believers. So these are people who believe the kinds of interventions that it's claimed can improve health and wellness. And more often than not, unfortunately, these are false claims. They're pseudoscientific claims. They're baseless. They're not really conforming to the scientific evidence. And believers are usually misled by other believers. So it's kind of the blind leading the blind. And sometimes believers are being duped by liars and bullshitters, and we'll get to them in a second. And the problem is that when people just indiscriminately believe in these kinds of wellness interventions without the kind of evidence or the skeptical, the critical scrutiny that we'd like to apply, is that they're not only just more prone to believing in pseudoscience and conspiracy theories, but they're also more likely to fall for fake news and share it online. So the more believers there are, the more misinformation about wellness gets spread. So those are kind of the believers. The bullshitters are an interesting group, because these are people who try to impress or persuade and mislead using this creative rhetoric that we can call bullshit. And this term bullshit was actually given a veneer of scientific credibility in the 80s when scientists tried to deconstruct what bullshit actually meant. And the main characteristic that distinguishes liars from bullshitters is that bullshitters have an indifference to the truth. So they might tell you the truth, they might give you falsehoods and lies. The whole point is to strategically further the goal. So it might be getting more followers online, elevating their status, making money, or whatever. Liars, by contrast, intentionally distort and fabricate the truth to mislead. And, you know, today with social media, they have a lot of tools at their disposal. So I think when you're navigating health and wellness, it can be useful just to think very briefly sometimes whether you're dealing with a believer, a liar, or bullshitter, and that can help you to understand their motives to some extent.
Yes, the thing about believers, of course, is that they're not bad people necessarily.
Right.
They're often extremely well-intentioned because they believe.
Absolutely. Victims.
You know, a classic one that you mentioned is, this may rankle some people, is homeopaths and homeopathic medicines, for example. Now, there is probably no stronger belief system for adherence of this anywhere. People really believe this, don't they? And even though the evidence for it is thin, if anything.
Yeah, I mean, homeopathy is a really interesting one because it's not just that the evidence doesn't support the efficacy of homeopathy. It's just to believe that homeopathy can have a beneficial effect is to believe in something that can defy the laws of chemistry. I mean, homeopathy is based on the idea that like cures like, and that something becomes more potent the more dilute it becomes. Now, if you've ever mixed a drink, whether it's an alcoholic drink or juice, or and you add more water to it, it becomes more dilute. It becomes weaker. That's just a basic law of chemistry. But the idea in homeopathy is that the more dilute something becomes, the more potent, the more powerful it is. So it just defies basic laws of chemistry. And, you know, I've had lots of dealings with homeopaths, and it's not just my opinion that this is a pseudoscience, that it doesn't work. It's just it's a basic law of science. So it's not my opinion, and people tend to get very upset with me when I tell them they think that I'm attacking them or attacking their beliefs. And no, I'm just sort of telling you what the science says, really. So don't shoot the messenger, as the saying goes. And yeah, you're absolutely right to say that believers are not bad people. They're not stupid people. They're not naive. They've just been misled in some capacity. So I think it's always very, very important to deal with believers with compassion, with interest, with sensitivity, because often people just been misled by another believer or a liar or a bullshitter. Telling them that they're stupid or being condescending is no help to anyone.
Yes, because here in the wellness space, as they say, this is the thing about belief systems, and people get cranky about it if you challenge, I guess, because the idea that, you know, you should disrespect a person's belief, I suppose, is this, it's tied up with this, isn't it? I mean, it's tied up with the idea that if you don't believe what I'm saying, you are disrespecting me and my belief system, which, you know, which is not tied up with science and scientific grounding. It's more about whether or not you're behaving properly, do you think?
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Look, humans are tribal animals, and at the end of the day, we all like to belong to certain groups. It makes us feel like we belong, and we will do whatever we have to do to protect the beliefs of the tribe. That's just the way that we've evolved. So when somebody tells you that your belief system is flawed, we take it personally and we will perform whatever mental gymnastics we need to do to protect our belief systems. So, and I find it a lot when people love the work that I do. I get contacted a lot by people who love what I've written about cupping, or they're just fascinated by how I can deconstruct the evidence behind acupuncture. But when I tell them that homeopathy doesn't work, they get offended. Or when it's fine until I touch on their belief system. And what we've got to be better at doing as human beings, if we're going to make good, smart decisions in the world, not just in wellness, but in the world in general, is we've got to be better at understanding when our beliefs are flawed, and we've got to be better at reflecting on our own biases and to understand more maybe when our biases are leading us astray. And when somebody tells you or when somebody questions your beliefs, don't take it as a personal attack. No. Just use it as an opportunity to turn the spotlight on your own consciousness. Maybe, you know, are my beliefs actually rooted in fact, or am I just doubling down because I don't want to be proven wrong? And so I think that's a really important part of being a good thinker.
Yeah. Yes. Taff in Maribyrnong sent me a very funny text just on the basis of has wellness taken over the world, and have we all gone completely and utterly bonkers? He says, here's an example of wellness BS gone mad. He sent me a photograph of the sick bag he had in his seat pocket on a recent flight home from Europe, and the bag is labelled your personal wellness bag.
Wow.
Well, no one's allowed to be sick anymore, are we? We're only at various stages of wellness, do you think?
Yeah, well, wellness is employed very deliberately by vendors and manufacturers, by the industry, because it doesn't really mean anything. You mentioned earlier on that it used to be the health aisle in the pharmacy or in the supermarket.
It did, didn't it? That's where you used to be able to buy, you know, really indigestible mueslis and things of that nature and other supplements. Because you ate these things, you know, because they were so bad that you could feel them doing you some good.
Right, but the marketing has evolved away from health because we're not allowed to make health-based claims anymore. Mm-hmm. Quite rightly so. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to do so if you're selling a drug because it's undergone a certain degree of scientific scrutiny, and there has to be a minimum threshold of evidence to support the use of a drug. And then the manufacturers of the drug can then make health-based or medical-based claims. You can't do that for anything in wellness because it hasn't been tested for and hasn't been approved for treating any kind of illness or disease or for improving health. So we employ the term wellness because it can mean pretty much anything. It's ambiguous and it can be defended, whether it's in court or whether it's just in an argument in the pub, to mean absolutely anything at all. It could mean improving energy levels. It could be improving immune function. It could be facilitating recovery, muscle function, psychological function, whatever you like. It really just has no operational definition at all. And that's the whole point, really.
Mm. Yes, Nick Tiller's with us. Dr. Nick Tiller is the author of the Skeptic's Guide to Sports Science. And we're talking about science-based wellness as opposed to belief-based wellness. John of Coburg says, Phil and Nick, I noted with some concern today that King Charles, that's the King of England, also our king here in Australia too, Nick, and yours, I guess, has a couple of royal warrants for homeopathic chemists and suppliers. I know the influence and reach of the royals has declined, says John, but I was gobsmacked by this mainstreaming of absolute quackery. Well, this is the thing about homeopathy. The royals have been into homeopathy for a long time, haven't they?
Oh, yeah, especially King Charles. Yeah, he's been a long-time proponent of homeopathic remedies for decades, in fact. And for the longest time, the UK's National Health Service put millions of pounds into funding NHS treatments and funding a homeopathic hospital through the NHS. And it was only a couple of years ago that funding was cut because of course there's no scientific evidence to support the use of homeopathy, but there's never been any good scientific evidence. So the fact that it's been supported for decades, I can only assume was because King Charles and obviously before that Prince Charles was a longtime supporter of homeopathy. But, you know, this is an interesting case of an appeal to authority. Yes, he's been the prince and now the king, but, you know, I'd rather take my medical advice from a medical professional, somebody who's qualified to give that kind of advice. And King Charles is not it, actually.
Mm. Quite a few of my texters have raised this issue, Nick, which is important, and that is that the whole field of wellness is hugely complicated by the placebo effect, isn't it? That if people believe something is doing them good, then it may well do them some good. The brain and the mind are powerful things. And so when you say these things can't possibly be doing you any good, and see, I've got texters here already who are vouching for homeopathic cures. So if you think it cured you, then I suppose in your own mind it did, didn't it?
Well, absolutely. And just on the previous point about King Charles, a colleague of mine, Edzard Ernst, has published a book some years ago called Charles, the Alternative King, an unauthorized biography. So it'd be remiss of me if anybody wants to learn more about Prince Charles and his sort of alternative therapy beliefs, they should definitely check out that book. But yeah, to your current point, you're absolutely right. The placebo effect is very, very powerful and it's very important. The idea that the placebo has very powerful psychobiological effects. If we believe something works, then in some respects it can work.
Yeah.
And if this is where the idea of something, when people say, well, it worked for me, this is often due to the placebo effect. So if somebody has some kind of muscle ache and they go and get acupuncture or cupping therapy, then sometimes it can relieve that muscle ache. And if you have benign headaches or if you're feeling nauseated, you can use a homeopathic remedy anybody work for you? The problem that we have is that when people use these placebo-based products, so these are products that work only in the context of expectation and belief, when people use those types of treatments for things that, for illnesses that need real medical interventions, then we start getting, it's a slippery slope and people get on thin ice. So if somebody has a bacterial infection, homeopathy just ain't going to cut it. If somebody has a muscle tear or they need some kind of surgery, then using acupuncture or cupping therapy, it's just not going to do. And there are many, many very tragic, very sad cases, not just in the scientific literature, but in the mainstream media, and you can look them up for yourself, of people using homeopathy and other alternative-based treatments to try and remedy real serious medical problems, and people lose their lives, and it causes millions of pounds, millions of dollars of economic damages. And we're not very good at being able to distinguish when something needs a real medical intervention and when we can use a placebo-based product. So I have this saying that urgency breeds necessity, which in turn breeds reality. In other words, when the shit hits the fan and when people need real medical advice, then they go straight to real experts. If you fall to the floor clutching your chest, you think you're having a heart attack, you don't call your nearest homeopath. You don't call your nearest cupping therapist. You call a real medical doctor. If you tear the labrum in your shoulder and your shoulder is, you know, falling out of its socket, you go and speak to an expert surgeon who has years and years of experience with real medical interventions. So when the shit hits the fan, people tend to turn to real medical professionals. And unfortunately, it's just we have this habit of turning to alternative therapists and wellness gurus when we perceive things to be a little bit less serious.
Yes, of which they can be divided into three groups, as we've decided: the believers, not necessarily bad people. There are the bullshit artists, as you say, who know it's wrong and continue on anyway, and the liars who... Well, they're just lying about what there is, about the effects that this will have. Annie in Creswick says, "Yeah, well, see, I knew we would get these messages. I got a bad reaction to bee stings. However, a dose of homeopathic Apis, the pain goes immediately. Please explain." Well, we can't, can we? But we can suggest that it's not because of the homeopathic remedy. Would that be your best answer, Nick?
Yeah, pretty much. Look, we know quite a lot about the human body. We don't know everything, especially about the brain. There are a lot of functions of the brain that are that science is still working on. But from a biological perspective, we understand the body pretty well, and especially the inflammatory reaction to bee stings. And we know that bee stings, with most kinds of stings, with other things like back pain, with benign headaches, they often just resolve on their own. So this is something that we call post hoc ergo propter hoc, and this is the idea that the correlation does not equal causation. So if you get a bee sting and you take some kind of sugar pill that has absolutely no active ingredient, and then the bee sting starts to feel better, we incorrectly assume that the sugar pill has cured the pain, has resolved the symptoms, when actually it's just that the symptoms probably resolved on their own. For everything we know about the human body that scientists have struggled for hundreds of years, and everything that we've learned since the scientific revolution tells us that there's no plausible way that a homeopathic remedy can actually resolve pain, can reduce the effects of bee stings. So it's more than likely that the pain just resolved on its own, as is the nature of bee stings and other kind of minor issues like that. So it almost certainly wasn't due to the homeopathic remedy. Look, if it works and you want to keep using it, I'm not telling you not to use homeopathic remedies for bee stings, but as long as you're pretty good at distinguishing when something can be resolved with homeopathy and when something needs a real medical intervention, as long as you can go and see a doctor and go and seek expert advice when it really matters, then the harm is relatively negligible. Not everyone can do that, unfortunately.
No, my texter says Steve Jobs died because he didn't listen to the doctors. Well, yeah, I mean, this. There's some evidence that that is the case. He may have died anyway. Well, he would have died anyway, but he certainly...
Well, perhaps I can give you an anecdote just to sort of to look at this from another angle. When some years ago I was... my grandfather, who passed away in his 80s, but he had a heart condition. He had a nasty stroke in his 40s. Mm-hmm. Required a surgery. He was under constant surveillance by his cardiologist, was on daily medication. And when I was in my teens, I learned that a friend of the family tried convincing him to take homeopathic digitalis instead of his heart medication. And this lady had spoken very passionately about homeopathy and how its curative effects. And she tried explaining to me in this long conversation how banging on the base of the container infused the formula with healing energies. And I'm really pleased to say that my granddad declined her offer repeatedly in favor of modern science and medicine and a little luck. And like I say, he lived until his early 80s. But imagine if he'd have taken her advice and he'd stopped taking his heart medication and hadn't gone to see his cardiologist and instead had taken homeopathic digitalis. I'm almost certain he wouldn't have made it to his 80s, maybe not even to his 50s or 60s. And so it's one thing using a homeopathic remedy for a bee sting, which in most cases is going to resolve on its own. But some homeopaths will propose that people stop taking their heart medication or their asthma medication or their cancer medication in favor of homeopathy. And that's, like I say, it's a slippery slope, and that's when it does real harm.
Mm. Yes, indeed. Rosalind from Dandenong. Hi, Rosalind.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well.
As I understand it, the late Queen Elizabeth was a believer in homeopathic medicine, and also Prince Henry's Hospital in Melbourne originally started out as a homeopathic hospital, and then it was amalgamated, 60s or something, into the medical, you know, ordinary hospitals.
Mm. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, she was. I think, Nick, you, I mean, you mentioned this already, she was. And, you know, homeopathy's had a lot of mainstream supporters, hasn't it? The only problem with it is, again, and we probably should move on from this topic, is that it's not supported by any science at all, is it? That's the point.
There's no scientific evidence for it. And also, I think I'd hasten to add that most people who are proponents of homeopathy don't actually understand what homeopathy is. Mm-hmm. Most homeopathic remedies, like I say, are based on the flawed premise that the more dilute something is, the more potent the treatment becomes. Mm. So it's literally the case. I think the average concentration is 20 c. Now, what that means is you get one drop of active ingredient to 100 drops of water. Okay, that's 1 c. You mix that up, you shake that up, you bang on the bottom of the container to infuse it with energy. You then take one drop of that fluid, that liquid, and you mix it with another 100 drops of water. So that's 2 c. You do that 20 times. Now, from a chemical perspective, once you've done that 20 times, there is no molecule of the active ingredient left in the original in the final mixture that you have there. But the homeopathic principle is that once you've mixed something 20 times, it becomes more potent than it was at the start. Now, this just defies all logic. It defies chemistry. Once people start to understand that about homeopathic remedies and the fact that it's based on the idea that like cures like, which is, not true, they start to question, actually, maybe homeopathy isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Then you can look at the scientific evidence and show that none of the controlled studies, you know, the double-blind randomized controlled trials on homeopathy show any benefit. This is something that, like you say, Phil, we need to move on from because it's really something that science long ago settled. And it's really, we sort of need to move on and start solving the bigger problems in the world because homeopathy really is something that needs to be left in the history books.
Let's move on from it. Can we talk about pickle juice? Now,
Sure.
This has become a thing, hasn't it? And the idea is that pickle juice is the liquid that you would find, you know, the salty vinegar. Well, it's mostly vinegar, I think, generally, that you would find in a jar of pickles. And apparently it's good if, because I know that you're a runner, it's apparently very good for cramp, we'd been told. I think you were telling me earlier that in the tennis world, the tennis players are all over it. Pickle juice. Is there anything in it?
Yeah, and this is an interesting case because, you know, we've gone from very harmful homeopathic remedies to something like pickle juice, and it seems like a bit of a paradox, one of them very important, one of them seemingly superficial, but they're all symptoms of a broader problem in wellness, and this is people believing in trends and fads without underlying scientific evidence. And you're absolutely right, it's a bit of a misnomer because this is not the juice of a pickle, it's just the brine in which the cucumbers ferment, right? The pickles themselves, I've written before, are kind of like healing crystals. They're purely decorative. But the active ingredients are like a lactic acid, the small amounts of potassium, magnesium, and salt, lots and lots of salt. Mm-hmm. And it's the idea, people have sort of are gripping tightly to pickle juice as a potential cure for cramp because we don't really know what causes cramp. And so people are desperate for some kind of solution to it. It ticks a lot of boxes. It feels kind of more authentic. It's cheap and homemade. It's like something your grandmother might have had lingering in the back of her refrigerator.
Yeah.
So it gives athletes a sense of autonomy. And it's kind of empowering to think that there is a natural remedy, that through some nutritional DIY, you can find a cure to something that is actually, if you've ever had a cramp, it's pretty nasty. It's very uncomfortable.
Is that right?
Painful.
And we don't know what causes them.
We don't really know what causes cramp. It's most likely the overfiring of motor units in the muscle. Mm-hmm. So basically the signals that tell the muscle to contract are overpowering signals that tell the muscles to relax. We don't really know what causes that. We know that it's probably not anything like dehydration. It's probably not even electrolyte imbalance or salt imbalances. There was an interesting study that was done a couple of years ago, and essentially the researchers triggered cramp in a group of people using electrical stimulation. And then they gave them either water or they gave them pickle juice. And they found that the cramp duration was cut in half when people took the pickle juice. Mm-hmm. But seeing as the cramp duration itself was about 90 seconds or so, that's not enough time for the pickle juice to get into the bloodstream. So it barely had enough time to reach the stomach, right? So it's got nothing to do with hydration. It's got nothing to do with salt imbalances in the body. So the authors kind of hypothesized that there must be some kind of receptors in the mouth that effectively short circuit the overfiring of the motor units in the muscle. And that's kind of been the enduring explanation for a long time. And if you ask even some performance nutritionists, they'll say that pickle juice, might work by this method, that there are receptors in the mouth and you can just rinse with pickle juice, you know, like a mouthwash. You don't even have to swallow it. But the problem that I have with this is that actually when people have searched for these receptors in the mouth, they can't find them. There's no way of measuring the actual mechanism that's being claimed. And when that original study from 2010 by a researcher called Kevin Miller and his colleagues from North Dakota State University, when they've tried to replicate that study, they couldn't. And studies where they've actually done the same procedures, they found actually no difference between water and pickle juice on the duration of cramp. So as far as I'm concerned, the evidence is really, really thin and conflicting, and there's no clear mechanism of action. But it's very popular because of cultural embedding. It's something that's caught on. Mm-hmm. People see their favorite athletes, their favorite tennis players drinking pickle juice on the court, and those kinds of visuals, those optics are often, well, they're much more powerful than scientific evidence, unfortunately. And that's sort of the wellness industry in a nutshell.
So where would you put pickle juice? In the believers and the BS artists or the liars?
Well, I think people are not really making a lot of money off pickle juice. It's not like people are, mass producing pickle juice and selling it in in little vials for people and making a lot of money off it. So I just think it's the result of a bit of cultural embedding, false authorities. They see athletes using it, and it's just something that's caught on. And so I think it's just the blind leading the blind. It's there's nothing particularly malicious or disingenuous. I just think it's based on a bit of a misunderstanding. Look, it may have some kind of effect. I'm just not that convinced based on the standard of evidence. There are other far more malicious and disingenuous products in wellness where people are actually making a lot of money off of scientific naivety, if you like.
Mm. Yes, we're getting plenty of suggestions as to what you should do with the pickle juice. It might be more useful to rub the affected area with the pickle juice than to drink it.
You can try that if you like. Might not be able to do it on the tennis court, but why not try?
You mightn't be very popular in the locker room afterwards either, I imagine, if you're smelling like a pickle. And plenty of suggestions about cramp cures as well. Look, on to a more serious matter. My guest is Dr. Nick Teller. He's written a best-selling book called The Skeptic's Guide to Sports Science, which was named one of the best sports science books of all time. And he's interested in scientific, calm, evidence-based research into what works and what doesn't, particularly in relation to health advice. This is more sinister, Nick, isn't it? And this is the campaign against seed oils. Now, this has become a thing in the wellness industry, that there's quite a substantial view. And in fact, I think Robert Kennedy, the US health cabinet minister, is on board with this as well. That may ring an alarm bell for you, I don't know. But this is the idea that seed oils, which they've scapegoated as the hateful eight, canola oil, corn oil, cottonseed, grapeseed, soy, rice bran, sunflower, safflower oils, are somehow inflammatory and toxic for you. Can you explain the background to this and where's all this come from and what the truth is?
Yeah, this is a fascinating case because, as you've said, these seed oils come from a bunch of different plant-based oils that have been branded the Hateful Eight, and they're
which have been around for a long time. Yeah, which have been around
for a long time. Mm. Yeah, since the early 1900s, people have been mass consuming these things. And, blamed for rising obesity rates. Of course, our obesity rates didn't start rising until the 1970s. So this was approximately six, seven decades after we started mass consuming seed oils. So there's a disconnect there. But they're essentially rich in polyunsaturated fats like omega-6, which are essential for brain function, bone health, metabolism, and so forth. And yes, critics are claiming they are toxic and inflammatory. RFK Jr., the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, is chief among them. And this is a bit of a problem because actually there's virtually no support from controlled studies for the inflammation hypothesis. The science advisory from the American Heart Association, drawing on randomized controlled trials and long-term animal feeding experiments, found that omega-6 fats actually lowered the risk of heart disease when they replaced saturated fats, cholesterol in the diet. And, okay, critics will argue that the American Heart Association have been bought off by big agriculture, as a money-making scheme. But it's not just the American Heart Association that have come to this conclusion. It's pretty much every major science and nutrition-based organization, government and non-government, all conclude the same thing. So unless you're going to postulate that every single one of them have been bought off by Big Ag, which kind of seems unlikely to me, then you've sort of got that's getting into conspiracy theory land. Mm. And but of course, it's really not just, this isn't really about seed oils. This is part of a much larger anti-establishment narrative. It's a worldview where basically scientific orthodoxy and scientific consensus is being painted as corrupt and self-serving. It's this idea that big food and big pharma are colluding with them to push toxic products. Mm. Seed oils are just the latest scapegoat. So this group of wellness influencers and wellness crusaders, they've already demonized sugar and pasteurized dairy, vaccines, sunscreen, GMOs, fluoride, seed oils are just the latest in a long list. And the whole point of this larger narrative is not to improve public health, because this won't improve public health. This will actually harm public health. Mm. But it's to erode public trust in science and medicine, to clear the way for a wellness movement that is built on identity-based consumption, and to make money. Mm. A lot of the people who are demonizing seed oils are selling alternative to seed oils in the form of animal fats and beef tallow and that kind of thing. So they are literally profiting from this kind of fear-mongering. And so it's not going to improve public health. It will only cause harm. And like I say, it's part of a much bigger, much more disingenuous narrative that is being pushed to essentially make money.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. It seems to... You're right in the sense that one of the threads in this is that if it's being pushed by big companies, multinational companies, big agricultural companies, big ag and big pharma, as we know is a pejorative term and has been for a long time, that if they're pushing it, then there is something sinister and wrong about it, and therefore it can't be right, and that somehow there's a more authentic truth out there. It's tied up with this kind of thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, and it comes back to basic conspiracy theory. Look, everybody likes to reclaim some autonomy over their health and their wellness, but ultimately we have to make decisions in this climate, and the best tool that we have to be able to make those decisions is the scientific evidence. And when you have 99% of scientific experts saying that seed oils are safe and actually beneficial, and you have 1% of scientific experts who are saying the contrary, and when you have wellness, unqualified, uncredentialed wellness influencers, and RFK Jr. Now, this is not a political statement. This is a statement of fact. He's not a medical professional. He has no scientific training, no medical training, and he's pushing this narrative. And you've got to sort of pick which camp you're going to sit in. And this is not a left versus right thing. This is not about political division. This is about evidence. And, you know, for my money, I'm going to throw in with the 99% of scientists and medical experts who say that this stuff is safe. The same reason that I get my COVID jab, the same reason I get my flu shot, the same reason that I I'm not anti-GMO. The same reason that I like having fluoride in my water, because it strengthens tooth enamel, because the scientists and the experts all say that these are beneficial interventions, and you sort of have to pick which camp you're going to be in based on some kind of logic and reason. So again, seed oils are just another symptom of a broader problem, a broader narrative.
Mm. Yes, the word wellness is a recent invention, says Caroline. It means nothing. Health professionals and normal people used to use the word well-being. Wellness is a seriously dodgy term devised by marketers and influencers that underpins a seriously dodgy industry. Yes, well, Caroline, I think that is part of the message that I think Nick is on about tonight. Nick Tiller's my guest. We're talking about having a sceptical eye about the wellness industry, which seems to have come out of nowhere to be a behemoth about belief systems, about what is good for you and what's not. Latif says, understand about homeopathy. What about naturopathic treatments and herbalism? Nick?
Yeah, interesting one. I mean, naturopathy really sits under the umbrella term of alternative therapy or complementary and alternative medicine, or CAM. Ed Zedance calls it scam, actually, supposed complementary and alternative medicine, and which I think is very apt. And I think last time I was on, I quoted Tim Minchin, because I quote him all the time, and he's actually, it's a wonderful quote. What do we call alternative medicine that's been proven to work? Medicine. And it's a joke. It's a one-liner that's laced with a lot more truth than it is sarcasm, because if something's actually shown to work, it will be adopted by mainstream science. And these are the kinds of things if something actually can be marketed to to cure some kind of health condition, then it will be controlled by prescription. You won't be able to get it in the supermarket aisle. You won't be able to get it in the wellness section. The fact that you can buy homeopathic remedies and naturopathic remedies and all of these kinds of placebo products in the wellness aisle without prescription, because they're not controlled, it is for the simple fact that they don't contain active ingredients. And they have not been tested and not been shown to actually provide any curative effects for anything. Mm. So this is an unregulated industry. It's completely uncontrolled. So unfortunately, yeah, well, look, we all want simple solutions to complex problems, but they don't exist by and large. So we have to be able to take a step back and see the bigger picture. See, this is a $4 trillion industry. And there are the reason that it's valued, has such a high market value, is because there are a lot of products on sale, all making promises that do not deliver, unfortunately. So yeah, the ability to take a step back and look at the bigger picture is absolutely crucial.
Just back on cramps, by the way, because we're getting a lot of traffic about cramps, Nick. people are saying we know what causes cramps. It's salt loss.
Nope.
But the answer is, this is a commonly held belief, isn't it? It's a very commonly held belief.
Do we? I mean, I'm an exercise scientist, right? And I have been for 2 decades. And I don't know what causes cramp. So I don't know where somewhere people have access to information I do not.
But we can say
that's an interesting one. I've learned something.
Yeah. We can say that salt loss of itself does not, we can't demonstrate that causes cramp, can we?
No, absolutely not, because people get cramp when they have absolutely stable salt content.
Sometimes you get one lying in
salt. Right, exactly, and people get cramps in, you know, I got a cramp at mile 8 of the London Marathon 1 year, and that was after 1 hour of exercise. That wasn't because of either dehydration or salt loss. And if you take blood samples from people who are having cramp, they oftentimes the levels of sodium and chloride, because salt is sodium chloride, are absolutely normal. And in many studies, you can actually trigger cramp in well-rested people who are well-hydrated and don't have any electrolyte imbalances. So it really it almost certainly has nothing to do with dehydration or electrolyte imbalances. It's probably due to some kind of either muscle fatigue or muscle damage. So the only way to really prevent cramps is to make sure that you're adequately trained for the exercise that you're doing. And when cramping actually comes about, the expert advice from people who have actually studied this, even guys like Kevin Miller, who have done these studies looking at pickle juice, in a review that he published himself, the advice is still, it's got nothing to do with pickle juice or taking electrolytes or anything else. It's rest, gentle stretching, and waiting for the symptoms to subside. So unfortunately, yes, we all want that magic elixir that's going to cure cramp when it comes on, but we don't have one.
And there's a bit of traffic too on the fact that you appear to be unaware of the fact that it's a known fact that that seed oil is bad because of the industrial heat that's applied to extract the oil. And this is the problem, Nick.
That they might need to go to elaborate a little bit more on that. Is that a problem for the environment, or is that a problem for the oil itself? Because
the oil itself.
Study after study has shown that actually when people consume seed oils in place of saturated fats, it actually can help to lower cholesterol and potentially lower the risk of cardiovascular disease. Now, we're not sure if that's a direct effect on the body or if it's just because saturated fats are being replaced. So it's kind of like driving isn't good for you, but if you previously rode a motorcycle, then switching to driving a car is going to improve your life expectancy. Right? It's not because driving a car itself is healthful. It's just motorcycles are, potentially dangerous. And I can say that because I have both a car and a motorcycle. Mm. So yes, it might just be that using seed oils is beneficial for health because we're taking less saturated fats from what we call, you know, bad fats, animal fats. But no, you'd have to heat oils to extraordinarily high temperatures for them to, for the chemical structure to change and for it to have a negative effect on the body. And most oftentimes, that isn't happening in the manufacturing process.
Nick Tiller's with us. Just before we go, Nick, very briefly on AI, which we know increasingly, I mean, it can be very useful for all sorts of things. Is it a good place to go to for health advice?
This is a question I get an awful lot because obviously AI chatbots are taking over. You know, they've been rapidly adopted across all sectors in business and medicine and science, academia. But most of the interactions with large language models, so we're talking about ChatGPT and Grok and Meta AI and all of their contemporaries, are coming from just regular people who are doing query-based searches. And actually, it's been studied, and most people now use AI chatbots in place of search engines. So whereas before they would have gone to Google and done a keyword search on whatever, is this diet helpful? Is this supplement beneficial? What are the side effects of vitamin D deficiency? They're now asking those same questions to AI chatbots. Now, on the one hand, these large language models are they're really good at giving you nice, comprehensive, complete answers. They're designed for one thing, and that is to mimic conversational fluency. So they can give these very quick, very convincing, authoritative answers. But what most people don't understand is that these AI chatbots are designed to mimic conversational fluency. They don't actually know anything. They can't make balanced, objective decisions based on evidence. So whereas before you could do your keyword search online and then maybe you'd look at the top 10 items that were returned and you could employ your critical faculties and you could say, okay, well that I'm going to ignore that resource because it doesn't look very authentic. This one comes from the Mayo Clinic, so that's a little bit more authoritative. This is a journal article, so maybe I'll give that a little bit more weight. AI chatbots don't do that. They're not capable of doing that.
No.
They are trained on vast text-based data sets. There's no guarantee what they're going to be trained on. They might be trained on mainstream articles, articles from journalists. They might be trained on scientific articles. Grok is based a lot on social media, actually, on X or Twitter. And as we all know, social media is a cesspit of misinformation. And so an AI chatbot really is only as good as the data on which it is trained. And as I've said, they don't actually know anything. They perform statistical patterns to predict the most likely word or phrase in a sentence. And unfortunately, they get things wrong a lot of the time.
That's true. It is true. Nick, it's been a fascinating conversation, as it always is when we talk. The way through this thicket of minefield of the modern world is to have a critical eye, as we know, and can sometimes be exhausting, but not more exhausting, I think, than trying to ponder in the wellness aisle of the supermarket. Nick Tiller has been our guide tonight. He's author of The Skeptic's Guide to Sports Science, and amongst many other articles as well. You can find him when you go looking, dare I say it, on a search engine powered by AI. Nick, terrific to talk. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you, Phil. Talk to you again.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.